Good morning. Welcome to this session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Oral arguments are regularly occurring in the courtroom at the Thomas J. Moyer Ohio Judicial Center in Columbus. It might look a little different today because we are in fact sitting in Jackson County in the auditorium of Jackson Middle School. On behalf of my colleagues and I, we thank Jackson and the greater Jackson community for all of your hospitality. Offsite court is designed to give school children and community members a bird's eye view of the work of the judiciary, to demystify, and if you will, to demonstrate the application of the rule of law. It is my hope that this introduction to the law will encourage many youth in the greater Jackson community to consider a career in the law and to come back to this community to serve the people of Jackson. Today marks the 83rd session of the Offsite Court program. Each year, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in local communities so that more citizens, in particular our youngest citizens, can see the court in action. We are here today at the invitation of Jackson County Common Pleas Judges Christopher Reagan and Justin Skeggs. Our thanks to Senator Shane Wilken, who is meeting with students this morning and represents the 17th District, which is all of Jackson County. In addition, we have a deep appreciation for the amount of work it takes to organize a visit like this. So we offer a special thank you to the educators in Jackson County and extend special recognition to Jackson Schools Superintendent Phil Howard, High School Principal Tyler Swackhammer, and Middle School Principal Tara Richards. Students from several schools will witness oral arguments today. In attendance are the students from our host school, Jackson High School, as well as students from Buckeye Hills Career Center, Christian Life Academy, Oak Hill High School, and Wellston High School. A great deal of class time preparation was dedicated to this visit, to preparing the students for what they're about ready to see. Teachers were joined by local volunteer attorneys in leading classroom discussions about the rule of law, the Ohio Constitution, and the role of Ohio's courts. It required reading by the students and included preview articles about the cases they will hear today. These summaries were written by the public information staff at the Supreme Court of Ohio, and everyone can access those at courtnewsohio.gov. To the educators and lawyers, thank you for creating an understanding of the law for hundreds of Jackson County's best and brightest. It is my hope that this exposure will lead some of those students to a career in the law. The Jackson County community needs you. In fact, 82 counties in Ohio are in urgent need of attorneys. Please consider law school, returning home, and serving the needs of families, business, and the community. Who knows? Sitting here today could be a future judge or justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio. We hope the offsite visit today will be your gateway to a career-filled, meaning, purpose-driven life. The judiciary has an important task in our society. In any dispute, there may be good arguments on both sides. Some may not be happy with the final decision, particularly if it doesn't go their way. But everyone can remain confident in the system where rules and laws are applied fairly and consistently. That is our job. The cases you will hear before us are on appeal. There has been a decision by a lower court, and a party has asked this court to review a specific issue in that case. After reading the briefs from each party and listening to oral arguments, the justices will review the applicable laws or constitutional issues, will research and deliberate. There will not be a decision today. To deepen your understanding of the process, I suggest you watch for the decision in these cases. Read the opinions to be a more informed citizen. I recommend that you learn why a certain decision is made, and you find that in the pages of the opinion. In fact, if any of you would like to see the opinion immediately when it is released, we have a registry at our website so that you can sign up for an email upon its release. The bench looks a little different today. Justice Patrick Fisher is not with us this morning, but he is fully participating in the oral arguments today. He is watching via Zoom, and he will fully participate in the deliberation of these cases. Once again, thank you to the entire Jackson County community, to our audience and viewers. Welcome to this official session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Marshall, will you call the court to order?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
In our first case this morning, 2022-1114, State of Ohio versus Dewan Wiley. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Martin, good morning, and thank you for coming to Jackson to participate in off-site court again.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court, and it is my pleasure to be here. May I have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
You may, if you'd adjust the microphone.
Yes, Your Honor. Dewan Wiley is going to get a second trial. The 8th District has so ruled. The question is, what's going to happen at that second trial? See, in that second trial, the jury says that Dewan Wiley is guilty of murder. If they say that they are not convinced that he acted under sudden passion, sudden rage, which would have reduced that murder down to, in this case, involuntary manslaughter, or that felonious assault in count two down to aggravated assault. If that second jury says that, what about the fact that the first jury that heard this case?
Isn't that fact, counsel, irrelevant, because the reversal just simply puts your client back at square one, as if that trial never happened, and presumed innocent?
No, Your Honor, it does not. Any more than if in the first trial my client had been found guilty in count one, or let's say in count two, we'll make it easy. In count two, if my client had been found guilty of simple assault as opposed to felonious assault, if there were a retrial, if there was a vacation of the first conviction, we all know that double jeopardy principles would say, well, you cannot be tried now on a greater offense having been found guilty of a lesser offense. Well, in this case, what we have is that 12 jurors, just as qualified as the next 12 that are going to hear this case, just as competent, made a decision beyond a reasonable doubt that my client acted on sudden passion and sudden rage. And we know they made that decision
even the state's burden to prove?
No, it was not. Rhodes.
It was a defense, right?
It was. Well, actually, Your Honor, in this case, because count three was a standalone voluntary manslaughter count, Rhodes tells us that no one had the burden. When voluntary manslaughter is indicted independently as a standalone, then no one takes the burden.
Then no one had the burden, so how could that finding be used against him for double jeopardy purposes, against the state?
Well, Your Honor, because collateral estoppel, which is a subset of double jeopardy, the flip side, if you will, of that two-sided double jeopardy coin.
Hasn't U.S. Supreme Court only applied that in cases of acquittal?
The Ash versus Swenson applied it to acquittal, but in Ash versus Swenson, the court talked about how it was concerned about the findings that had been made by the jury. And so in Ash versus Swenson,
and subsequent Supreme Court cases have really limited Ash, right?
There's been some limitation of Ash, Your Honor, but no overruling of Ash, Ash binds this court.
This court to those facts, though, right? These aren't those facts.
Your Honor, these facts are actually less, my facts are more compelling. for an application of the principles of Ash versus Swenson than were the facts in Ash versus Swenson. Let me explain. In Ash versus Swenson, we have a situation where a defendant is charged with the robbery of victim number one. The jury comes back and says, we find the defendant not guilty because the evidence was insufficient. Now, we don't know for certain whether the jury was concerned about the fact that there was evidence that was insufficient of venue. We don't know if what it was that the jury was necessarily saying by that. And yet, what the U.S. Supreme Court said is, we're going to take a practical approach, we're going to use common sense, we're going to look at the evidence. And when we look at the evidence, it is clear that the only thing this jury could have been concluding was that this man was not proven to be one of the robbers. And if he wasn't proven to be one of the robbers with respect to victim number one, then the court turns around and says, as to victims two through six, that finding, that issue preclusion, the issue being identity, is going to have a permanent effect on this case. Now, in our case, you don't have to make any inferences. This jury was told, you do not come back with a guilty verdict on count three unless you find sudden passion, sudden rage. And sudden passion, sudden rage is a mitigator. It's a different form of a lesser, yes, Your Honor.
But didn't they then come back also with a conviction on a count that doesn't require certain sudden rage and passion? So how do we know which one they really meant?
There's no inconsistencies here in this verdict, in these verdicts, and here's why. In count one, the jury found that my client knowingly caused serious physical harm that resulted in death. In count two, but they were not given the opportunity to decide, did he do that while under sudden passion, sudden rage? They just didn't reach, they didn't have the opportunity to reach that issue. It wasn't on the table. Count two, did my client knowingly cause serious physical harm? They said yes. Once again, they were not given the opportunity to say, was this under sudden passion, sudden rage? Count three, did my client knowingly cause death? And this time, they were invited to make, not invited, ordered to make that decision of was this sudden passion, sudden fit of rage. Should they have been given that instruction? To go back to Mr. Justice DeWine's question, no. Under Rhodes, they should not have been. But they did it. They made it. 12 peers of my client made that decision. The state asked them to make it. The state went so far as to say to the jury, we have voluntary manslaughter, a quote from the closing argument that we've mentioned in our reply brief. And the jury was clearly instructed, if you don't find sudden passion, sudden fit of rage, you do not come back with a guilty verdict on count three. They came back with the guilty verdict on count three. And that tells you beyond peradventure that they made that finding. If you are not willing, as the state is, to concede that that finding has been made definitively, then you call into question an even more fundamental legal precept. And that is, do we or do we not presume that juries follow the instructions of the court? If juries follow the instructions of the court, and we rely on that bedrock principle in every single case, if they follow the instructions of the court, then we know in this case that 12 people told this court, this man acted under sudden passion, sudden fit of rage. And if he did that, and if in fact, therefore, the offense of conviction should have been involuntary manslaughter on count one, aggravated assault on count two, had they been given that instruction, then you cannot say to DeJuan Wiley, now you go back for a trial in which we're going to forget about the fact that those 12 made that decision, and you can go to prison for the rest of your life, even though we had jury number one said the mitigator was there, jury number two says no, and we don't even get a game three rubber match. Double jeopardy precludes that possibility. Double jeopardy says the state has its one shot. In this case, in that first shot, the state went so far as to tell the jury, there's sudden passion here. There's sudden fit of rage. He should be found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. And now they would suggest to you that it gets erased. And the amicus says, well, this was a tactical decision by the state, by the defense, that they could have just said, well, find him, just give us the voluntary manslaughter conviction on count three and let us go away. But in order to do that, what the amicus misses is that there were other issues in this appeal, including ineffective assistance of counsel. We don't have to give up other issues on appeal in order to invoke the double jeopardy rights that Ash versus Swenson guarantees us. Therein lies the problem in this case. We do not have an inconsistent verdict. We have one jury that was given the opportunity to pass on everything. And when they did, they said that what happened here was under sudden passion, sudden fit of rage. So what do we do about that? What we do about that, since the 8th District has told us we have to have a new trial on all three counts, is we go back and say, okay, we're going to put a ceiling then on that new trial. We're going to deal with, in count one, an involuntary manslaughter charge at this point. We're going to treat count one similar to the way Rhodes tells us to treat voluntary manslaughter, and we're going to tell the jury in this second case that what they're dealing with is involuntary manslaughter with an ag assault predicate, and they have to decide whether or not the defendant knowingly caused serious physical harm that resulted in death. And if they so say, then at that point, we will have a conviction for involuntary manslaughter with the ag assault predicate. And in count two, on felonious assault, we're going to say, do you find knowingly caused serious physical harm? And if they so say, it will now be ag assault, because just as the grand jury baked in to count three that mitigating element of sudden passion, sudden rage, and therefore takes it away from the Pettit jury, so too, the first jury in this case, having made that finding, and not just by a preponderance, but by beyond a reasonable doubt, not only were they instructed on this, but they were instructed to an even higher standard, and they still found it. And that finding is issue preclusive and says that on counts one and two, murder as to count one is off the table, felonious assault as to count two is off the table. Voluntary manslaughter this time will instruct properly under Rhodes. It's not a question of simply saying the first conviction is all gone, and therefore there's nothing left to worry about, and therefore it has no effect. We don't ignore the fact that a jury made that type of mitigating finding any more than we would ignore the fact that a jury had found a defendant guilty of a lesser included offense. And if the case came back for an evidentiary ruling, or if the case came back because of ineffective assistance of counsel or anything else, we would say to the defendant, you will not run the gauntlet of the greater charge when a jury of your peers has already said, that's not what you did. I saw the white light flash for a second and then go away. There are no further questions.
I have one.
Please.
So we've got double jeopardy and we've got issue preclusion. And I'm just going to take it from the standpoint of issue preclusion.
Sure.
The strength of that in the jury's finding is implicit, not any kind of direct question. How do you want to resolve that?
If I understand Your Honor's question, the strength of the finding in this case is direct, not implicit, because the jury was directly told, you cannot return a verdict on count three of guilty unless you find sudden passion, sudden fit of rage. So that verdict of guilty on count three means that we, the jury, have found beyond a reasonable doubt pursuant to the instructions given that DeJuan Wiley acted under sudden passion, sudden fit of rage. And that finding permeates the entirety of the trial. The fact that the jury was not given the opportunity to make that finding in counts one and two through the mistake of the trial court, and that's why the 8th District has sent one and two back. The fact that they were not able to make that finding should not be held against DeJuan Wiley, because we know in this case that given that opportunity, not only would they have made it, they did make it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Van, good morning, and thank you for agreeing to participate in off-site court.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Van, Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Cuyahoga County, representing the state of Ohio. It's a pleasure to be here this morning at the court's off-site session. Again, on behalf of the state of Ohio, our position here today, this morning, we believe that the court should affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. And there's three reasons that drive the outcome here, at least in the state's view. First, there can simply be no double jeopardy issue without an acquittal. There has been no acquittal in this case except for the involuntary manslaughter count, but no such acquittal that would preclude the state from seeking or from having a new trial again on the felony murder count. Second, collateral estoppel simply just does not apply when a new trial is ordered. Now, collateral estoppel is part of the double jeopardy clause, as the U.S. Supreme Court indicated in Ashe.
Well, collateral estoppel can apply when a new trial is ordered, right? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court seemed to say that a motion for a mistrial doesn't preclude the collateral estoppel argument. That's what it said in Ashe.
Sure, to clarify, in circumstances where there is an acquittal, and that's where I would draw the distinction, because if we go back to the facts of Ashe, right, so that was a case involving a card game, there was a robbery, there was a trial with the first victim, and from all intents and purposes, from the facts, it was clear that these victims were robbed, it was clear that there was a robbery, the only issue there was identity, and the jury in that case acquitted the defendant of the robbery offense. The prosecution moves on to another prosecution involving another victim. And that's where the collateral estoppel issue came in, because it was apparent from the facts of that trial, that first trial where there was an acquittal, that the jury believed that the defendant was not involved in that robbery. Therefore, in that case, it was appropriate, or the U.S. Supreme Court indicated it was appropriate to apply collateral estoppel in that case. Double jeopardy applied in that instance.
Mr. Van?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you clarify for me, at no time the trial court, at no time, I don't think the trial court instructed the jury on the burden of proof for provocation?
Correct, I believe so.
Meaning that it was the defendant's burden of proof and what that level of proof was.
Yes.
For provocation, am I correct on that?
I don't recall the exact instruction on the burden on the.
As far as provocation goes.
Provocation goes, case law does indicate that the burden is on the defendant by a preponderance of the evidence. But you know the crux of the error, or at least the error that the Eighth District found, was error in how the jury instructed, or rather how the court instructed the jury between the felony murder count and the voluntary murder count. And you know, I'm going to say,
my point is, your colleague on the other side said that the jury's finding on provocation was direct and not implicit. But if there were no specific instructions about provocation and who had the burden of proof to prove provocation, does that weigh more in favor of implicit rather than direct in the jury's finding of guilt on voluntary manslaughter?
You know, I'm not sure I would read much more into that based on the fact that the jury returned the guilty verdict on the felony murder, and the guilty verdict on the voluntary manslaughter. Now, if there is an issue, an error on a jury instruction, and that this is what this case is about, an error in jury instructions, or at least a perceived error in jury instructions, the typical remedy for any type of jury instruction error is a new trial. The defendant in this case, in the briefing below, and this is my third point, is that the defendant essentially acquiesced, or rather invited, the new trial on the remaining counts for which there was a guilty verdict. He invited the new trial on felony murder and voluntary manslaughter. Now, it was his preference, and this is in the conclusion of the appellant's brief, that you know his preference was just a trial on voluntary manslaughter. He also indicates, alternatively, you know, I should get a new trial on the remaining counts. In addition, the very crux of appellant's case was the First District's decision in Duncan. Now, I think it's far from settled law whether voluntary manslaughter is an...
Well, so let me ask you about that. Why did the state ask the sentencing judge not to sentence him on the murder charge?
You know,
I understand that Duncan decision, but it's hard to think that that's really good law.
Well, I think in you know any given case, given the Allied Defense statute, in some discussion with the prosecutor who handled the case, you know, when it comes to murder, it is the state's election. And that doesn't have to be at all times an election on the greater offense. I think in this particular case, you know, the prosecutor exercised judgment and within discretion.
Why didn't the state file a cross appeal?
in hindsight, you know, perhaps we should have filed a cross appeal in this case. Certainly, we could have. You know, footnote one of the opinion below cites to the First District decision Everett. There's also the decision Hawthorne out of the Fifth District, which you know clearly holds that voluntary manslaughter is not inferior to felony murder. I do think, at least in my own assessment of the case, how the case was briefed below, that there were some issues. If you look at the Eighth District's denial of reconsideration, much of the arguments I could have made in a memo in support of jurisdiction, the Eighth District indicated in their recon denial that a lot of these arguments were being raised for the first time. So just in totality of just our assessment of the case, a decision was made not to pursue a cross appeal. But if we were to set all that aside, any potential issues that, you know, we were wrong below about the analysis of inferior degree offense, if we look at the root issue involved, this was a jury instruction issue, and the remedy for a jury when a court holds that there was an error in a jury instruction, the remedy is a new trial. And that's what appellant asked for. That's what he received.
Counsel, following up on Justice DeWine's question, do you think that the trial prosecutor requested the judge to sentence on voluntary manslaughter because, as an officer bound to seek the truth, was giving deference to that finding of the mitigation of provocation in this case? And
I'm not sure that was the instance. I think it was more of a holistic view of the case in its entirety, the facts, what testimony had come out at the trial.
I just wondered, because in my experience as a trial court judge, when two counts merged, it was usually the case where the state elected to serve his sentence on the, when they had that choice, on the more severe charge. And it struck me that maybe they were giving deference to the fact that this jury had found provocation.
I think that may have been the circumstance. What I will say also is that there is, I believe that there's an adequate basis factually for both the felony murder count, which in this instance was predicated on a felonious assault, so that didn't necessarily require the intent to kill, whereas voluntary manslaughter did require the intent to kill. That was just simply mitigated. Now again, in totality in this case, there's not much case law to support the position being advanced here today. I think every case that's been cited by appellant is distinguishable from the facts we have here. I discussed Ash previously. The closest case that appellant draws the court's attention to is a case out of Texas, the Watkins case, which again, it's distinguishable, and it's a different set of circumstance because there was no acquittal in that case. What that case was a death penalty case, a murder case, in which at a penalty phase, the jury found provocation. And then when it came to the next trial, an attempted murder case involving a separate victim, that's where the court applied those principles in Ash. Simply put, there's no authority that's been cited that would support an application of Ash in this case. There's been no acquittal, so double jeopardy doesn't apply. And again, the remedy as ordered by the Court of Appeals was essentially acquiesced to. Again, everything that appellant based his argument on, the Duncan case, which is questionable, but we are here now. That case did order a new trial. If there are no further questions from the court, I would again simply ask the court to affirm the remedy that's been ordered below. And I just simply want to acknowledge that the OPA brief filed in this case does go through quite a bit of analysis of Rhodes. So I think we did want to be careful in how we explained provocation aspects. I think it's simple here to just simply indicate that because a new trial had been ordered based on a perceived jury instruction error, that the remedy stands.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, you've used your time, but we'll give you a minute.
May it please the court. Thank you, Chief Justice Kennedy, for your kindness. I want to go back to Justice Bruner's question. At pages 775 and 776 of the record, trial court gave the jury instructions
on voluntary, on sudden passion, sudden fit of rage, and treated sudden passion, sudden fit of rage as an element, and concluded that section by saying, if you find the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt each and every one of the essential elements of the offense of voluntary manslaughter, it was clearly instructed beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that was error, right?
Yes, Your Honor?
That was an error for the court to make give that instruction.
That is correct. And an error in which neither party objected. But, and then secondly.
So why shouldn't we do what the OPA says? There seems like there's just a myriad of problems with this case. Why not just IA this case?
Because if you IA this case, Your Honor, my client's going back to trial on a murder charge. If you IA this case, then it doesn't go away in this situation. What happens is my client now faces the potential for life in prison, despite the fact that 12 of his peers have already said that he acted under sudden passion. And if I could, that segues into going back to Ash for 1 second at page 443 of the Ash decision, where it talks about collateral estoppel, and it says the following. It's not worried necessarily just about acquittals. It says that collateral estoppel, quote, means simply that when an issue of ultimate fact has once been determined.
But with all due respect, you say that without any reference to the court's subsequent decision in Currier, which severely limited Ash, didn't it?
Currier limits Ash, but it nonetheless does not overrule Ash. And Ash's concern about issues of ultimate fact determined by is the question here. I mean, you cannot get, respectfully, the state cannot escape the fact that 12 people said it was sudden passion, it was sudden fit of rage. They elected the first time to go with voluntary manslaughter.
Mr. Martin, you didn't get to read the second part of the transcript. As far as you got when you were reading what was in the transcript, you said on pages 775 and 776, the jury was instructed on sudden passion and rage. Was the jury instructed on whose burden it was to prove it?
They were instructed that it was the state's burden to prove it. But what's essential, Your Honor,
that was error.
Well, yes, it was error to instruct on any burden at all. But what's essential here for purposes of Ash versus Swenson and what's for purposes of this case in double jeopardy is that regardless of whose burden it was, they found it. They found that it existed. If this had been a situation where they did not find it, then we can worry about who had the burden. But the fact is that when they did find it, regardless of who they were told had that burden, and the state, by the way, took on that burden in its closing argument. But the fact of the matter is they found it.
So,
they
said, what is the burden? What's the level of the burden?
In situations where sudden passion, sudden fit of rage is an issue for the jury, the burden is on the defense by a preponderance.
So how can we be certain, I guess preponderance being the lowest, I guess if they found that, then you can assume they found it by a preponderance. That's where you're going, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. They only would have had, in a retrial, they would only have to find it by a preponderance as to counts 1 and 2. They've already found it beyond a reasonable doubt, the gold standard. And therefore, we know that they made that finding. Regardless of who bore the burden, the essential nature of the instruction was, if you find it, he's guilty.
Okay, so
they
what's
said
the
he's
conclusion?
Guilty.
You didn't, weren't able to finish your statement about Ash. What's the conclusion when an issue of ultimate fact has been determined? What is the conclusion of Ash?
When an issue of ultimate fact has, this is the quote, has once been determined by a valid and final judgment, that issue cannot again be litigated between the same parties in any future lawsuit.
So was the 8th District in error for vacating the jury's verdict on voluntary manslaughter?
The 8th District, the voluntary manslaughter was challenged because of the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, because of some other issues in the case. The 8th District did not need to vacate the voluntary manslaughter conviction, but they did. And when they did, they've ordered a new trial on it. And the state did not appeal that. And in fact, it can be argued acquiesced in that because they knew that without that voluntary manslaughter caboose, the murder train could not be retried. If voluntary manslaughter had stayed on as a conviction that remained extant, then you would have a situation where there would be a real mess when it comes to trying a murder charge in count one at a second trial. And so what the 8th District has said is, oh, we're just going to start all over. But you can't just start all over and ignore findings by a jury that benefit the defendant. And I say benefit the defendant because we have the protection of the Fifth Amendment. The state does not. And it's that benefit of the Fifth Amendment double jeopardy clause that says Mr. Wiley does not run the gauntlet of a second trial. I don't have to look at Mr. Wiley and say, okay, we're going to have to prove that you acted under sudden passion, sudden fit of rage, if we want to get to a mitigating verdict, if we can't get a complete acquittal on self-defense, which is what we believe we deserve. But Mr. Wiley, we're going to have to go for that again. And he's going to look at me and he's going to say, wait a minute, didn't that already happen? There are no further questions. I reiterate my prayer.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a copy of a decision from the court.